Chicanismo, and I'm Carlos Chavez. I recently had an opportunity to sit down with filmmaker Jill Friedberg, speaking on her latest film, A Little Bit of So Much Truth. This film documents the people's struggle in Oaxaca, where a teacher strike bloomed into an enormous movement in southern Mexico, unlike any other movement in history. Jill Friedberg will be presenting her film tomorrow night at the Hollywood Theater on Sandy Boulevard in Portland, Oregon. I encourage anyone to go and check out this movie. It's a wonderful piece. We open up our dialogue here, talking about what this movie will encompass. We're talking about the latest film that you've come out with. You've done several. This is your third film. I think people are really familiar with the film that you came out with. This is What Democracy Looks Like. I think probably any activist has seen that movie. That's like a staple. Very well-made movie. And I got a chance to watch your latest movie last night, Un Poquito de Tanta Verdad, A Little Bit of So Much Truth. And in the same way, I thought, I was impressed by how clear the story was told, and from the point of the people, not the point of any type of a commercial standpoint or what have you. You can clearly see what was going on down there, and that story was a lot different than what people got to hear about, if they even got to hear about it. Mm-hmm. Being that this is your third film, what changes did you make? Did you change your approach or anything like that with this latest film? And, you know, what even drew you to this subject? What even made you start to put this film together?
Well, I guess I'll answer the second half of the question first. I had been down in Oaxaca, Mexico, between 2003 and 2005, working on a previous film, Granito de Arena, which is a history of the Mexican teachers' movement in Mexico. It's a social movement of public school teachers who have been fighting to defend public education for about 25 years, and that movement has its strongest base in Oaxaca. So I was there making that film between 2003 2005, specifically with the idea of bringing the film back to the U.S. especially, and other countries, to be used as an organizing tool by public education community, especially teachers in the U.S. and their efforts to fight privatization, No Child Left Behind, that sort of thing. So in the process of working on that film, I was also working with the public school teachers in Mexico, in Oaxaca, in their efforts to start their first community radio station in the city of Oaxaca, Radio Plantón. And that radio station is the radio station that was destroyed in 2006 when the state police attacked the striking teachers in their protest encampment, which was the moment that that sparked this massive nonviolent popular uprising that the current film is about, Un Poquito Tanta Verdad. And I actually wasn't originally thinking that I was going to make another film in Oaxaca, make a film about what was happening, but then this social movement in Oaxaca started taking over radio stations and eventually took over a television station, all nonviolent takeovers, and started using these media outlets to organize and defend their social movement. And it was just, to me, such an unprecedented series of events, and what I thought would be really, really, offered some really, really important lessons to people in this country and other countries in terms of, you know, the role that the media play in our lives and what we want to do about the media climate that we live under. So that was how I kind of came to making this film, and I don't know that I've changed my approach that much since making This Is What Democracy Looks Like, in terms of you know, making documentaries about social movements with the intention of having those films be used as organizing, mobilizing tools by other communities of action.
One of the things that you just mentioned was that, you know, this was an unprecedented or a series of extraordinary events that created one big movement there in Oaxaca, Mexico. And one of the parallels that I see with this movie and the other movie is it was a large collective effort by the people of, you know, each city to really make something happen. In this movie, the one thing that I thought was really interesting were the creative ways that people went about mobilizing the mass of people that they had to work with, and they all did it as one unit. They all agreed. They all came up with you know, a collective approach to this whole thing. I was wondering if you could talk about, more specifically about how they were able to, in one scene in the movie, the mujeres, the women of Oaxaca, of the movement that was going on there in Oaxaca, took over the Channel 9 news station there, or TV station. They, it was completely done nonviolently, all women, and they were able to broadcast on national TV what, you know, something that countered a lot of the BS that the commercial media was putting out there. How were they able to do that in a nonviolent way?
Well, I mean, the situation when that happened, the situation in Oaxaca was already really unique. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people from sort of across socioeconomic and across ideological and political spectrums, all mobilizing and organizing together in a very horizontal way. I mean, the movement in Oaxaca organized itself with an assembly, which in Oaxaca references indigenous governance traditions, horizontal, leaderless, consensus-based organizing and decision-making. And that through that organizing process, the people of Oaxaca had basically succeeded in placing the city of Oaxaca and large parts of the state under popular control. By the time the women took over the television station, you hadn't seen a uniformed police officer in the city of Oaxaca for 2 months. And so the city really was this sort of, you know, occupied zone. So when the women went to take over the TV station, which was really a spontaneous act, I mean, there had been talk of doing that, but nobody had yet actually had the guts to do it. And the women had a women's march that day. It ended up being much bigger than they had expected it to be. And at the end of the march, somebody just said, let's go take over Channel 9, which was the state television station. In many ways, consider, you know, they considered it to be their television station. Their taxes paid for it, but they had never had a voice on that television station. So it was a very spontaneous act, and I think that they were able to do that nonviolently, in part because there were so many of them. I mean, they showed up, 3,000 women showed up at the door of the television station. There were probably 15 or 20 employees inside and the manager, and they didn't actually show up to take it over. They showed up saying, we'd like an hour on the air, and the manager said, you can't have an hour on the air. So they said, all right, well, then we're going to take over. We're going to take over your TV station. There was very little that the staff and the manager could have done if they had wanted to prevent them from taking it over. But also, I believe that a lot of the people working inside the station supported them. I mean, a lot of them, not all of them, were well-paid, high-up employees, and that's what the women, after they took over the TV station, said. They said a lot of the staff actually helped show us how to use the equipment, and we made them dinner, and then after they showed us how to run the equipment, we let them leave. So, you know, and it really did. You had, for 3 weeks, 24 hours a day, a state television station in the hands of these women who basically opened it up as a space where anybody and everybody could come in and talk about the injustices that they had been enduring. And it was, you know, not only the first time anything like that had happened in Mexico, it was the first time anything like that had happened anywhere in the world.
I remember, you know, we're speaking about how the media was kind of turned upside down, really, in my view, in a positive way, probably the most positive way it could be done. I remember when this was happening in 2006, I remember searching websites and looking, you know, in various news outlets, both independent and commercial, just to see what was being said about the events down there. And I remember finding it really difficult to really figure out what the heck was going on, even through the independent lens. You know, one thing that got a lot of attention was the death of Brad Will. But one of the things that I found very striking in the movie was how the media was interpreting things on a commercial level. The amount of slander, the amount of misinformation that was out there in the commercial media was overwhelming to me. And to actually see what was going on the ground was a completely different story, which is, you know, this one of the reasons that I really recommend that anybody watch this movie. What are your thoughts on that whole scope of things?
Well, the media landscape in Mexico is very similar to the media landscape that we have in this country. I mean, the television and radio in Mexico are owned by a small handful of some of the richest families in the country with very specific economic and political interests. And so as soon as the conflict erupted in Oaxaca, the discourse on the state and national commercial television and radio was that a small handful of radical vandals were small handful of radical vandals were destroying one of Mexico's most beautiful tourist destinations. And they use the same terminology that the media in this country use. They use the word terrorist. They did a lot of fear-mongering. They use the words radical and vandal, riots. They love the word riot. And so that was, you know, that was the information that was getting out at a national level in Mexico. And the international commercial press very much mimicked that once they started paying attention to Oaxaca. They really didn't start paying attention to Oaxaca until a white American male was killed there, and then suddenly Oaxaca was on the map for the international press. But whereas the media landscape in the U.S. and Mexico are very similar, I mean, the differences are examples like what happened in Oaxaca, where the people really are willing to recognize the importance of having enough community media, whether it's legal or not, to counter the discourse in the commercial press. They recognize that importance and were actually willing to take measures to have the means of communication in their hands to actually be able to confront that discourse.
The key words that the commercial media was using there, similar to what is often used in a lot of the commercial programs here in the United States, one of the key words being terror. You know, that's the popular key word nowadays. Communism is no longer popular. The key word is now terror, and that seems to get everyone going. That word was thrown around all over the place in the commercial media down there. But what you see in the movie on the ground is how the people that represented the media, the people that were in the upper class, that represented the people who were actually oppressing the people that were in the struggle, were the ones who were the terrorizers of this entire movement. I was wondering if you could speak on that.
Yeah, I mean, the discourse in the commercial media in Mexico sort of set up the justification for the brutal repression that was used against the movement, and repression from a lot of different fronts. I mean, we had, starting with the state police, but then that evolved into paramilitary attacks in the city on a nightly basis, paramilitary and parapolice forces, state and municipal police, plainclothes, going out in caravans of truckloads of them, going out every night and opening fire on nonviolent protest encampments, and then finally the sending of thousands of federal police, but militarily trained federal police into the city. And these were, you know, hundreds of people were detained and tortured. There's still over 30 people who are disappeared. People who were detained were held out of police helicopters and told that they were going to be thrown into the abyss. Women who were arrested were raped. And so, you know, when you see on the mainstream media, they're saying that the people that are participating in this social movement in Oaxaca are terrorists. But when you look at the footage in the film, for example, you see old women and young children and school teachers and health workers. And then the actual acts of terrorism are being carried out by the state and federal police and paramilitary and parapolice forces paid by the state government.
In the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night, but also, I mean, there were times in Oaxaca where it was also right in the middle of the day, in the middle of downtown Oaxaca City, operating with an absolute and complete impunity. And part of that impunity was given to them by the mainstream media that had created this dynamic where people were led to believe that the social movement in Oaxaca was being led by radical terrorists, and therefore it was okay to use such extreme repressive measures against them.
Yeah, there are a lot of parallels to many different things in this movie that I found interesting. I mean, it made me think about what happened in Chile when Allende was overthrown. There were parts of it that reminded me of what's going on in Palestine. But it also reminded me of issues that we've dealt with in this country regarding Native American people. I myself, I don't like to use the word Native American because I see all of the people of the Western Hemisphere as indigenous people, whether they're from Mexico or whether they're from Alaska or wherever. But to me, you know, this is another indigenous struggle that was occurring. Oaxaca's has the highest percentage of indigenous, different types of indigenous populations just within that state. And I see this as another example of the oppression that's being done to indigenous people. I was wondering if you had some words on that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, when they talked about the uprising in Oaxaca, they talked about it very much in the context of 2006, that this was a popular uprising that started because there was a, you know, police attack on a teacher strike, and the people decided they wanted to get rid of the governor. But really, what happened in Oaxaca happened because of decades and centuries of resistance by the indigenous peoples, the 16 different indigenous peoples that live in Oaxaca. There are decades of organizing and resistance against decades and centuries of social, economic, cultural, and racial injustice. And that's very much the situation in all of Mexico, and especially in southern Mexico, in Oaxaca, Chiapas, Guerrero. And that what happened in 2006 was able to happen because of that long history of indigenous resistance in southern Mexico, and the fact that the movement organized itself as an assembly directly referencing indigenous governance traditions in Oaxaca was, I mean, that it has everything to do with that history of resistance. So I think it is important to place these struggles in a historical context, and also talk a little bit about how they reference each other. You know, how did the struggle in Oaxaca reference the Zapatista movement, the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas, and other indigenous struggles in other parts of the Americas? So I think it's difficult. It's dangerous to talk about what happened in Oaxaca without referencing that history.
Well, we're talking about your movie, a little bit of So Much Truth. I really recommend this movie to everyone. I want everyone to know that this is going to be playing tomorrow night at the Hollywood Theater on Sandy Boulevard in Northeast Portland. It starts at 7:00. Mm-hmm. You're going to be there for the film as well, right? I was wondering if you could just say a few more words about where people can find out more information about your films and how to get more information on some of the content.
Yeah, more information about this film and my other films at corrugate.org, which is corrugate.org. Information about Oaxaca that's in English has gotten a lot harder to get a hold of, but Oaxaca Indie Media is a relatively good source. Narconews.com is also still covering the situation in Oaxaca. Obviously, in Spanish, there's quite a bit more information available on the internet. I guess I'd probably recommend that people start also with Indie Media Oaxaca and the newspaper La Jornada, which is a national newspaper in Mexico, and then go from there.
We're talking about indie media. We're talking about alternatives to commercial media. It's a lot of what you deal with. That's quite a bit of your background. We're moving into our membership drive, and I was wondering if you could speak on the importance of independent media and a radio station such as KBOO.
Well, I think, I mean, this film especially, and that's part of the reason that I made this film, was really to sort of have the film be used in conversations about the importance of alternative media, community media, independent media, and what happened in Oaxaca really demonstrates that clearly. And I think that folks who value that in this country need to recognize that, you know, the alternative and community and independent media that we have access to in this country now should not be taken for granted. I actually grew up in Portland and did a lot of Central America solidarity organizing in the 80s, and KBOO was always, whenever we had a fundraising event, whenever we had an outreach event, it was always co-sponsored by KBOO. KBOO always helped to get the word out. So, you know, 20 years later, I'm back showing my film and KBOO's co-sponsoring the event. So it's not just that the community, that the radio itself is a place where people can hear and have their voices heard, but also that it's a radio station that's actually participating in the community, and I would encourage people not to take it for granted.
Jill Friedberg, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.